Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Golf Beneath the Surface podcast. My name is Raymond Pryor, my co-host, and your friend and your pal, Chase Cooper, with me here. Today is part two of habits, which is a bit of a sticky subject. There's some layers to it. It's funny how habits are something that comes very easily and very quickly to us, but understanding them is something that has some layers to it, which is why a lot of people have difficulty changing habits, because there's a couple of kind of nuanced areas about it that if you don't really understand, makes it really difficult to make change for us. And so today we'll get into that a little bit more. We'll recap a little bit the last episode that we had and kind of the first, it was kind of about understanding habits and then the first stage. Like if I was going to start to change a habit, where would we start based on what the research shows us and how our brain works? And today we'll get into a little bit more about if we wanted to change habits, how do we get in there? But it's a heavy subject in terms of kind of some of the layers in it, Chase, which you and I have been kind of trying to work through a little bit here.
Yeah, I'm thankful that you say it's a heavy subject because I've spent all last week kind of going through and making sure I still completely understand what the heck a habit is. When we met a couple years ago, I never dreamed we would do multiple episodes on habits, and I never dreamed that something that seems so simple, a habit, is so so detailed and how our brain organizes all this. It's really fascinating to me. And I hope you guys are getting a lot out of this at home because it's really cool.
Yeah. Our brains, it's a really cool thing, but it works in some complicated ways at times relative, like, and even our simplest behaviors, there's many, many mechanisms behind that in our brain that are running those types of things that make it seem very simple and straightforward to us in terms of what we see in our behavior, our responses, how quickly our feelings and thoughts might generate. But there's a lot going on behind that, you know, in terms of how it's just our brain works pretty quickly.
So Before we dive into level two of habits, let's go back and do a real quick recap of what we talked about last week. So a couple of the things I wrote down and add on to this doc as we go. So number one, we as humans are designed to change. So I think that was a big thing that I took away. Neuroplasticity is the brain's ability to change based off our experiences for the good and what we perceive as good, but not always good for us. The old brain is the fastest, strongest part of our brain. And that's where these habits get kind of put in this set it and forget it mode.
Yep. That's the area of our brain running our habits. And the reason it's running our habits is because that is the fastest and strongest part of our brain, which is why things come so easily and so quickly to us. You know, if the slower, weaker parts were running our habits, it would take a lot more conscious thought, a lot more effort, a lot more time to jump into those types of things.
Yeah, perfect. So then young brain is the slower, weaker kind of rational thinking side of our brain. Habits are just basically behaviors that then get repeated enough that they move to that old set it and forget it side of the brain.
That's right. They either get repeated enough or they are reinforced intensely enough. And it's usually a combination of both. Right. So something that feels really good to us is reinforced faster than something that is just kind of neutral. But if you then also put a bunch of reps behind that, that's what makes it a habit. So, for example, right now, one of the habits that is super common to a lot of people is like scrolling through social media. Yeah. Like that feels good for our brain. It's easy access dopamine and it's a lot of reps. So that is a habit that'll get reinforced very quickly. Similarly, negatively reinforced habits are the ones the reinforcement is, I feel like at least I'm doing something to alleviate discomfort, alleviate uncertainty, to feel safer. And those register to our brain and our nervous system. They are heavy reinforcement feelings. Like imagine if I could offer you a behavior, Chase, that would make you feel that your children are safe all the time.
Yeah.
Like that would feel very reinforcing to you. And if you throw some reps behind it, that's going to move from a conscious choice to a habit very quickly.
Yeah. And so like, that's what I was going to say. The ones that are more negative reinforcing would be more of those survival-based behaviors.
Right. Yeah. And again, well, yes and no. So the survival-based positive reinforcement might be like see food, trigger, eat food, behavior, reinforcer, feel full, feel good, being, you know, whatever. So the flavor is essentially reinforcing to us and the nourishment we get. Getting food is a survival behavior. What you're talking about, the ones are more protection survival. These are these negatively reinforced ones, which is like trigger, saber-tooth tiger, behavior, run away, reinforcement, feel safe, right? Or at times actually be safe. And those ones are, so essentially our negatively reinforced behaviors are far more likely to be reinforced by feelings of safety, comfort, and certainty. which again, in survival, life and death situations where physical harm is available to us, or even like trauma, these can be very helpful behaviors, right? But when we're in settings where we really want to thrive, like the golf course or in our relationships and the jobs that we have, they can be more unproductive. So again, they're not good or bad. It's like, what setting are they in play for? And then what does that actually grant me access to?
Okay. So you've mentioned already, but now we've got the three things to the habit is a trigger, a behavior, and a reward. And we were talking before we started, this is kind of like the trigger is the event, could be really anything, right? An internal event, meaning like I've got a putt to shoot my lowest round and I'm feeling the response to my lowest round would be heart rate goes up, or I get nervous, or I get excited, or I, you know, there could be good responses or negative responses, right?
Right. So your triggers, which we might just say an event, could be both internal and external. So an external event might be a slippery putt to shoot your best score ever. Could also be a thought that pops up, a feeling that pops up, a physiological reaction. Those would be more internally driven.
Okay, cool. And then the reward is basically the reason why we did the response. Could be that we're trying harder, or we're trying to feel like we're motivating ourselves to do better, or could be whatever the reason is.
You can think of the reason as like, what are we trying to create, right? Or what are we trying to do? So it's not the action, both internal. Again, behaviors can be both internal and external. So we might say trigger is an event. Behavior is my response that I have to this trigger or to this event. And the reward, again, people might be listening going, well, some of these behaviors don't seem very rewarding. It's not like a reward, like your brain rewarding you for something. The reward is essentially, what does my brain get in response to doing this? Like, think of reward like something that is more rewarding, is more reinforcing than something that is less rewarding. Okay. So again, it's the reason I'm doing something. So if it's first T, trigger or event, nerves or anxiety would be my behavior or my response to it. The reward is my brain thinking or feeling that it's doing something to try to help me get off that first tee or avoid getting off the first tee in a really unproductive way, right? So now whether we're actually getting that or not, as we'll talk about today, may or may not be the case. But ultimately, again, it's that feeling or that perception of what I'm getting or creating that is creating that reinforcement schedule.
Okay. And then one thing to kind of touch on that we talked about a little bit off air too, I wrote down 9 out of 10, which is really interesting to me. Like in a thriving environment like golf, we would take 9 out of 10 putts made from 8 feet, 7 feet, hitting good tee shots 9 out of 10 times, but the brain does not accept 9 out of 10 when it comes to a survival environment with a saber-tooth tiger or whatever. And I thought that was something that I talked to a player about this morning, that it really helped them kind of get like the brain is always in survival mode.
Well, if you think about what our brain is like any other organ in our body, priority number one is to make sure that we are safe and alive. And so, again, our brain has learned to overestimate not only the likelihood of negative events, but also the potential consequences of them, because it is designed to save you from that 1 out of 10 event, not to allow you to explore the other 9 with the risk of the 1%, unless we take action in order to allow that to happen. So if we're relying on our default survival settings in our brain, it wants us to play safe, essentially. Now, playing safe strategically and playing safe psychologically in a thriving-based setting, usually not the best strategy for us to be able to perform well. And also, if we're talking about listeners here who are trying to enjoy golf more, playing golf in your survival settings is far less enjoyable than allowing yourself to thrive, which again, if you have a series of habits that you've developed that are all these kind of avoidance-based survival strategies, and you apply them in a thriving setting, you can see how it kind of chips away at the experience. And then you're always going to feel like your performance is gated, meaning my skill level's here, but I only have limited access to it because the behaviors and the way, and again, behaviors are thought patterns, emotional patterns, actual physical actions, the things that I rely on to try to open up my skill set, by definition, cannot do so.
Gotcha. So, okay. again, this is very layered. This is very nuanced. So, again, you guys have any questions on this? I know it took me a week to kind of process episode one on habits, and I'm still out of my element a little bit on this too, and still kind of working through it. So feel free, fire away at the questions, and we will definitely get to them. And like I said, we'll probably do a Q&A just on habits. So bear with us as we get into level two.
Sure. And then let's do just a quick recap of stage one of changing a habit. So again, based on how our brain learns habits, meaning it starts usually in our young brain and then it moves into our old brain into automatic processing. When it's in automatic processing, set it and forget it mode, which just means we don't have to think about it for it to go. Okay. And it comes very easily. It comes very quickly. When it's in set it and forget it mode, automatic mode, the way we pull it out of automatic processing is to pay conscious attention to it. So essentially what that means is to shine a light on it with our young brain by just paying attention to it in the way that it was learned, which is a trigger behavior reward, or the terminology we might use today is event response and reward being like the reason that you would do something, right? Or the reason your brain thinks it's doing something for you. Okay. And when you pay attention to it non-judgmentally means just, okay, there it is. Not, oh, I shouldn't be doing this or I can't be doing this. Just paying attention to it over and over again and actually writing it out as a trigger, a behavior, and a reward. What happens is the research shows after about 7 to 10 days, you can't help but see it consciously. And usually you start to see it before it starts happening or while it's happening, which is pretty much the indicator that you're out of just full on subconscious processing and you're into conscious awareness with it. And this is really important because if we don't pull it out of subconscious processing in automatic mode, it doesn't change. Or our brain is designed to preserve that behavior until we've pulled it out of automatic processing. And this is part of the reason why many people have a difficult time changing habits, because they're trying to replace one that they have by just engaging with another when their brain is still operating the first behavior on automatic. And then they're trying to essentially consciously or we might say like intentionally just fill that space with another one where their brain is like, no, I got one all set here, right? Which can make it really difficult to change by just trying to replace one behavior with another.
And also too, going back to as we started as golfers, some of these habits that helped us get better start to limit us as we get even, you know, higher up the skill level. So like going back to the trigger, bad shot, the behavior is a harsh dialogue or talking, you know, saying bad things to yourself. And then the reward is, come on, man, you got to try harder. You got to try to motivate yourself to do better.
Right. Yeah, and again, in quotes. Right.
Yeah. And so that's where when we're just starting as a 30, 35, 40 handicap and just trying to work on low point and get the ball in the air, doing some of that habit can help us improve. But then once we get up and we're playing at a scratch golfer level or even playing on the PGA Tour, using that same habit and trying to tell ourselves to do better after we, you know, pull hooked an iron shot in the water on 17 when we weren't in the right mindset is probably not a habit that's going to be conducive to playing our best golf.
Probably not. I would say that really harsh self-critical inner dialogue, the shelf life on that for how helpful it is one of the shortest for people. And again, it's not that we don't want to hold ourselves accountable to a certain standard of performance, certain standard of execution, or a certain standard of effort. The challenge with that one is that it also creates a series of echo habits like shame and embarrassment that we know unless you actually address that shame and embarrassment at the source, you can't get to other behaviors. So that is one that runs out really quick. Along those lines, something like perfectionism on the low end of the learning curve, when just applying effort, even if it's misguided and kind of mindless, just putting in effort and doing something and putting in a bunch of reps, like we do know perfectionism does start to lead to improvement. But as you've alluded to, when you get to the top of the learning curve and it's less about the quantity of repetition and it's more about the quality of execution, it starts to run out pretty quick and it can actually lead to a lot of anxiety. It tends to lead to a fear of failure. It destabilizes confidence and it makes the experience less enjoyable for us.
And so then if we're working with a player on trying to get rid of that habit, right, we want them to document every time that and it could be multiple triggers. It doesn't have to be the same trigger.
Could be multiple triggers for the same habit. That's right.
One pulled putt or a blocked shot to the right or whatever. But multiple triggers could create that same harsh dialogue. And so then we want them to document it every time. And then I guess my question to you, Doc, is like, and you've said this already, but like what are we trying to do after we document it a little bit? What's the next step?
Yeah. So the first one is to just write it out whenever it happens. So again, could be multiple triggers. It could be I hit a funky shot in my warm up, and now all of a sudden I'm trying to be perfect with my positions to create a perfect whatever. I'm trying to have the perfect warm up. I'm trying to have the perfect practice. So I hit a shot in practice that is anything less than perfect, and I just get really angry about it. Again, trying to motivate myself to a better standard, whatever it might be.
Right.
Or I'm playing golf and I notice that just the whole time, the trigger is just playing under pressure behavior, trying to be perfect the whole time. And of course, the reward for that is it feels like you're doing something to try to perform better, which again is very motivating or very rewarding to our brain. That like, hey, if you did this, you would play better. That's super reinforcing for our brain. So again, what you would do in stage one is one, after you've identified probably a series of habits that you have, and you kind of put them into the category of not productive for me. And not productive means it's not contributing to the type of golf experience that I want to have. It's disrupting my physical skills and decisions on the course. And it's also, let's just say, not helping you score better. Right. Then again, for a week or 10 days, particularly if you're playing and practicing quite a bit, anytime you see it pop up, you go, trigger was this, response was this. And think about, again, reward, like for the reason of, and then fill in that blank and just rinse and repeat, rinse and repeat, rinse and repeat. And the more you write it out, the more you can't help but see it without it running on automatic.
Okay, so real quick before we jump into stage two, let's go through a few more of these trigger behavior rewards. So like, let's say I'm going to throw out some different events. Playing with a new group or playing with people that are better than you. Okay. Right. So then comparison would be the behavior. I'm trying to compare, or worried about embarrassment, or worried about what they think, fear of being judged.
There you go.
Okay. And then again, I'm still struggling at times with the reward. So then
the reward for that is to feels like you're going to avoid judgment playing with new people, or comparison to myself. It feels like I'm doing something, quote unquote, to build confidence.
Okay.
Right. So again, you almost think about it. Well, if this behavior actually worked in the way I want it to, what would it do? That's your reward for your brain. Because again, it doesn't know really whether it's doing that. It's still operating based on, well, when I did this in the past, it felt kind of like this. And I just got enough reps with it where that's where it became a thing for me.
Okay.
So those would be examples. Another example would be something like you could do a physical behavior that is really a manifestation of an internal behavior. So you could go first tee would be the trigger behavior. Steery, guidey, don't go left kind of swing. The reward for that is don't hit it, feeling like I'm doing something to not hit it left. Yeah, right. And like by the way, if you hit it a mile right, your brain is being reinforced for that because you told it anything but left. When it hits it right, it gets reinforced and your brain goes, you're welcome.
Yeah.
Right. If we put it into a really extreme example, it's slippery putt behavior. Yips, which is just deep, deep, deep anxiety in the form of getting pretty close to panic.
Yeah.
The reward for your brain is I'm getting you out of this putt as fast as possible and onto the next one so you don't have to be uncomfortable, or basically like you don't think you can handle this. So essentially this means like you are so far beyond being able to navigate this situation. I'm just going to take over and we're just going to do whatever we need to do to survive.
Okay.
Right. So if you're getting down to the nitty gritty on the yips, the habit pattern would go trigger, whatever shot and internal situations trigger that for you, behavior, anxiety to the nth degree, which is the yips. And then what the physical manifestation is kind of the jerky motion or the difficulty pulling the club back,
which
the reward for your brain is you're alive. Well, you're welcome.
Avoid or get through it as quickly as possible.
Avoid it at all the costs or get through it as soon as possible, which is just another way of survive.
All right. So I'm going to run through two more examples that I thought of, like trying to finish off a round of golf. We're getting later on in the round, 17th to 18th hole. And again, trying to shoot, we got a good round going. So the event is playing well. The response is, you know, off time thought, being in the future, being in the past, trying to, you know, I guess the response would be to protect, even though that would also be the reward too. Could be, we're trying to protect an outcome.
Yeah. Right. So you think about what is the reward? Well, it's the reason that I would do something. So if I told you trigger, great round going, almost finished behavior, start playing safe and scared to just get it to the clubhouse. The reward for that is don't screw up your current score.
Yeah.
Right. Problem is usually doesn't work that way. Yeah. Right. So,
awesome.
So that would be a really good example too of, you know, and that's why you see people oftentimes have two different nines.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, really bad first nine, good second nine, or vice versa. Cool. Yeah. So I think that gives everybody a good idea. Again, for me, it's been identifying what these habits are, the event and the behavior are the easy part, the reward and why, because you always think a reward is being a good thing. Like if I'm thirsty, I'm going to go get water so I feel fulfilled, basically, or thirst quenched. But some of these rewards, when we get into the more minutia of some of these golf specific habits we're diving into, really gets foggy for me when I'm trying to figure out how to do it. So giving you guys examples of all these different habits, I think, is because it's starting to shed more light on like how the brain is going to react to these events.
Yeah. And you might think about a way to help identify the reward is to ask the question, what am I hoping to gain from this behavior? Right. So if it's trigger, again, first T, behavior, anxiety, well, what is my brain hoping to gain? A better experience on the first tee, a better shot, avoiding a terrible shot, avoiding judgment, whatever it's trying to do for you. That's really what your reward is. And it's not so important that you get the exact thing, because it usually just comes in the form of trying to create comfort, certainty, or safety.
Trying to guarantee something is what I keep coming back to.
That's right. It's trying to guarantee something that is probably not available to you in a thriving setting anyway.
Perfect.
Okay. So once you have done that for a while and you've not just identified that your series of habits, but also we call this stage one mapping. Trigger, writing it out, trigger, behavior, reward. It's just what we call mapping your habits. And stage one mapping is just bringing them out of automatic processing and into conscious awareness. And the cool thing about our brain is that when we bring something into conscious awareness, our brain kind of does this really cool thing where it goes, okay, let's actually find out how rewarding this really is. So if you think about reward, the terminology, like the technical terminology for our neurological processes is reward value. And it's think about it like, again, our behaviors are in a hierarchy, and the most reinforcing, not necessarily the most feel good, but the most reinforcing behaviors to us are at the top of this hierarchy. And the reason there's a hierarchy is so our brain knows when these types of triggers pop up, where to go to right away, which is part of the reason why it's so quick for us to go to the same responses over and over again. It's in cue, right? And so reward value, a behavior with a higher reward value means it's more reinforcing to me or has been reinforced more than other behaviors. Therefore, it's at the top of the list that my brain will go, okay, here's that trigger. What do we go to? This one. Because it has the highest reward value, meaning it either makes me feel really good and works really well, or it alleviates it alleviates the most discomfort, most uncertainty, and makes me feel safer, like I'm doing something to, and then fill in whatever blank. Okay. Needless to say, it's important to point out here, the behaviors that we have that are oftentimes the least productive for us thriving are the ones with the highest reward value, because they make us feel as if we are safe, certain, and more comfortable, even though that might not be what they're actually doing. So what we'll see in stage two, as we map here, is we're going to find out that reward that we were paying attention to in stage one that we've been kind of sifting through, it's outdated, right? And so the essence of stage two mapping of habits in terms of changing it is, if we want to change a behavior, we have to do what's called disenchanting our brain about a behavior, which essentially means we have to show it how unrewarding it really is. Right. The process is not that different than in the research. They actually use this example, which is no different than if your dog takes a dump in your house, you kind of push its nose in it and you show it how stinky and nasty it is, because then it becomes a far less appealing option. So in essence, stage one is taking our habits out of automatic processing. It is then now open for audit. And then we have to show ourselves and our brain, caveat here, through our direct experience, not conceptually, but through our direct experience, that this is not at all getting me what I hope it was getting. So the reward that I see in stage one is not at all the reward that I'm actually getting. And I have to have unequivocal evidence of that. What that looks like is you still map it like you would in stage one. So you go trigger, behavior, reward, in parentheses now, the outdated reward. So the same you would map in the first stage. Now, the second stage is we just add two questions to it. And these two questions are very deliberate, because they are the language that our old brain speaks. That language, first and foremost, again, what reinforces our habits is what we feel. This is our direct felt experience, our sensory experience, you might say. That is, so what does it feel like when you are anxious? So that question we're asking ourselves is, what does it feel like when you are engaged with this behavior? Not way back when, not perhaps conceptually, no, right now, what does it feel like? So let's say, for example, you said playing in front of other people is a trigger behavior. Try to avoid being judged at all costs, which usually means I'm just playing safe and scared. The reward for that would be, well, that would save me from being judged by other people in a way that I don't want to. Well, I ask myself, what does it feel like playing golf with other people, trying not to be judged the entire time?
It sucks.
And it sucks, right? And then we want to be specific. What does it feel like? It feels really constricting. It feels like I'm gating my ability. It feels like I'm walking on eggshells. I feel anxious, like I feel heavy in my chest. Whatever your sensory feeling experience, how you directly experience that behavior and that experience is what we want to start to pull out, because that shows our old brain that is running this automatic habit, this doesn't feel nearly as good as you think it does. In fact, it feels pretty bad. And the cool thing about our brain is it is designed to move away from things that don't feel very good. This is why we don't like food that doesn't taste very good, why we don't like being out when it's too hot or too cold. It is designed to move toward things that feel good. And by feel good, I mean feel better. So if I gave you the option between one food and you were only picking on flavor, you would pick the one that tastes better than the one that doesn't, right? And so if I have option for different behaviors that I can go to, my brain has a higher reward value for things that feel better than for things that feel worse. And so if I show it, you are not actually avoiding the uncertainty, the discomfort, and you are not making me safer, and you feel really crappy, it starts to pay attention to that. And essentially what happens is it starts to move the reward value. So that behavior moves down the hierarchy and becomes less likely to be pulled out in the future. So that would be the first question as part of stage two mapping. Chase, you were going to jump in here. Go ahead.
Yeah. So here's where I'm struggling with this. So the brain rewards things that feel much better to it than things that feel bad. And everybody that has ever fought the yips is like, dude, the yips feel like the worst thing in the world, right?
Yeah.
And I know that the yips are your brain's way of trying to survive. And again, either avoid the issue altogether, avoid the threat altogether, or get through the threat as quickly as possible. This is where I'm struggling with this, because the other problem is the same habit could be used in a surviving situation that's also used on the golf course in a thriving situation. So how are you going to, I'm going to say reprogram, I know that's not necessarily the right word, but like, how are you going to get the brain to differentiate between me pulling a wedge out with a tight lie over a bunker versus the same anxious feeling when I'm worried about a bad storm coming and I need to survive, or I need to worry about an actual threat that could harm my chance of surviving. How do we differentiate between the two?
You're differentiating between the two because you are being very clear about what the trigger is. So the trigger being a tornado coming in is a different trigger than pulling a wedge out of the bag. Hence the stage one and how you continue that stage one mapping in stage two. So you're showing it repeatedly. This trigger or this series of triggers.
This is a safe trigger.
Right. This is everything is triggering to us. So triggering is this like very clinical therapy term that's been kind of bastardized.
Yeah.
Everything is triggering to us, right? That's how our brain works. It triggers behaviors, right? But if I show it this trigger, meaning when I pull a wedge on a tight lie, you go into full anxiety mode, hoping that you're going to get me through this in a safe and effective way. And then you ask it, well, how do I actually feel when I'm doing this? It feels miserable. And that becomes less appealing for your brain, okay? And your brain is attuned enough to know the difference between a tornado and a wedge, okay? So again, if I show it, the first question is just, what does it feel like when I do this? And it doesn't take long for us to go, obviously, I don't want to do this. We know that conceptually, like you're pointing out, your old brain does not speak in concepts. Like it doesn't speak in like conceptual understanding. It speaks in direct experience, hence the feeling. Like conceptually, you know, drinking sour milk's not a good idea for you. But until you taste it and how awful it is, then your brain goes, yeah, we're not interested in that at all whatsoever, right? It's the same process that works for any of our other behaviors. And again, it's a repetition thing. The more you show it, when this event happens, you respond with this, and this is what it feels like over and over again. And that feeling is uncomfortable or worse and makes us feel things that we don't really want to feel in that experience. it starts paying attention to that. And as you pay attention to that more and more, our brain, both parts of our brain, both young and old, start to become less enchanted with that idea. Okay. Here's the second question we ask, which gets into a little bit more conceptual understanding, but really it's just, again, what are the direct consequences? So the question you would ask is, what are you actually getting from this? Not what does it feel like you're getting, which is the original reward. So now that we're assuming that out, that reward is outdated, what do I actually get from this? So for example, first T, trigger, behavior, anxiety, reward, doing something to save myself from a bad round of golf. Well, what does it actually feel like? Anxiety feels heavy. My physiology is on fire the whole time. I'm feeling a sense of dread. I'm just waiting for a bad shot to happen. I can't wait to get to the end of the experience. Like, I just want to get through my round as fast as possible, not as well as possible, and all the things that come with feeling anxiety when we're trying to thrive. Then you ask, what are you actually getting from it? And I usually have, you can do this as an open-ended question, or you can do it kind of laundry list bullet points, which I'll do with some clients. For example, I might ask, does it actually give you more control or do you get less control? Less. Does it create a sense of certainty that you're hoping for, or do you become more uncertain? Oh, more uncertain. Does it actually make you feel more comfortable, or does it actually contribute to your discomfort? Oh, discomfort. Interesting. Does it make your confidence more stable or less stable? Way less stable. Then get into the nitty-gritty of your golf. Does it allow you full access to your skills, or is it always limited and gated and disrupted? Oh, disrupted. Okay. Yeah. Does it make golf more enjoyable or less enjoyable? Way less enjoyable. And does it help you score in the way that you want to, or does it make it harder to do that? Way harder. You might even get to, does it actually help you avoid embarrassments and disappointment and failure, or does it make those things far more likely, right? So again, it's not a conceptual conversation. It's, if anything, stage two habit mapping is not an intellectual exercise. You're just looking at cause and effect in the language that your old brain speaks, which is one, feelings, your sensory experience, and two, direct consequences, meaning what is the cause and effect? And again, way back when, if you showed your brain that this behavior that I'm trying to survive or thrive with feels terrible and doesn't work at all in the way that I think it would, we would be less, we are very disenchanted with returning to that behavior over time, right? So the analogy I use with this is, feel like this are two, I'm offering you two different golf balls or a golf ball, and you're going, trigger, play golf, behavior, this golf ball. For the reason, helps me play better and it makes a better experience. Okay. Does it actually, what does it actually feel like playing this golf ball? Oh, it actually feels like I'm hitting a rock. Okay. So that doesn't feel very good. And then what do you actually get from it? Terrible performance from my golf ball. No idea how it's going to spin, et cetera, et cetera. If I told you that and all you did was pay attention to it over and over again, you would become very disenchanted and unappeal. The idea of playing with that golf ball would become very unappealing for us very quickly. Right. The challenge with this is you have to do this consistently enough to start to show your brain that this default thing that it goes to really quickly that used to have a really high reward value, it is not getting that. And you have to show it over and over and over again. Most of the research shows, again, for about 10 to 14 days, that every time this behavior pops up, does not feel as good as you think it does. Now, here's a little bit of a caveat. What if the behavior does feel kind of good, right? So for example, trigger, walk in the house, behavior, pop in front of the TV and drink a beer, you know, reward, feels good. Okay. Right. But if what you're trying to do is live a healthier, more active lifestyle, you have to pay attention to more of the sensory experience that is not in line with that. So for example, it might be trigger, walk in the house, behavior, sit down in front of the TV, drink a beer, reward, feels good. Then you ask, well, how does it feel? And you got to get a little bit specific, like, how does it feel? Making yourself less healthy or moving farther away from the things, the life that you want. In a similar way, you might go with golf. Well, a steery swing works for me sometimes. Then the question becomes, well, how does it feel to hit this steery little, please don't go somewhere swing when you're capable of hitting it much, much better, right? So you're pulling out, where's the part that just does not feel aligned with the kind of life and the performance that I want to have? And then again, you're asking yourself what you get from it. And that might be mixed. So for example, come home, trigger, behavior, sit down, watch TV, have a beer, reward. Well, it does feel good. But what does it feel like to be making myself less healthy over time? I don't really like the idea of that. That doesn't feel very good. What are you also getting from it? Unhealthier by the day, gaining weight, you know, feeling like I'm wasting kind of my time sitting in front of the TV. And again, this is just a generic example, but really what you're doing is, does this feel the way that I really want to feel? And is this is the cause and effect of this behavior actually in line with the type of life experiences, performance outcomes that I do actually want to pursue?
And so, like, in that case, right? Cause I kind of keep bringing this back to golf, but that's kind of interesting. I come home after a long day and I'm tired, and the only thing I want to do is sit down on the couch my vice is Cokes, as you know. I like to drink Cokes. So I'll sit down and drink a Coke, even though I know that at almost 40 and as much Coke as I drink, that's not healthy. And like, so if I can go through this, the stage one mapping, it'll get to a point where I'll come home and my brain is almost saying, well, the triggers the couch, and the brain will almost like go back the other way. Like, don't sit down, you lazy ass, basically. Like, yeah, other stuff.
I might ask you a question. What does it feel like to be a prisoner to Coke?
Yeah, right.
And you go, I don't like that idea. Right. Like that doesn't feel very good. Right. Then you might go, okay, well, what are you getting if you actually sit down? And part of that might be, well, I would feel more relaxed and I would just physically feel better. But then when I say, well, what is it? What are you actually getting? And you'd go, a bunch of sugar and calories I don't need. I'm not engaged with the types of things that I really want to do, perhaps, et cetera, and kind of going down the line. Right. And then again, you get to make a choice about, is this, or which of these is more in line with the type of life, the type of activities that I want to have, the type of experiences I want to have in my life. Again, you might choose to have a Coke sometimes.
Yeah.
But the fact that it's just, as soon as I walk in the door, my brain goes, where's my Coke?
Yeah.
Is a pretty clear indicator that it's become a habit, right?
My wife is nodding somewhere or will be nodding when she listens to this episode. Okay. So I understand good habits that are good for us. I understand bad habits that aren't good for us and that but bad habits that we like my Coke drinking habit. What I'm still foggy on is I keep going back to the yips because it's so easy to talk about. I know that every time I have my struggle's been, I've talked to you about this. I think I've talked about this on here. I've struggled with like slow uphill putts, like 15, 20 footers, 30 footers that are uphill. Like when I have to hit it hard, I'll struggle and I'll get kind of yippy flinches. I know it feels terrible. I know what I'm supposed to tell myself, but I still haven't completely, completely fixed it. And so whether it's somebody that has a really bad case of the chipping yips, the trigger is pulling out a wedge, or even a lot of times it's even seeing the ball where, you know, on the tight lie.
It could be, I hit a shot and I know it's not on the green. I know it's around the green. It could it could also be just like the feeling of anxiety as you're walking up to a shot. Again, the triggers can also be behaviors and vice versa.
And a lot of times it can even be like, I've taken it back and it's a quick trigger and it runs through this whole thing real quick. And then we flinch.
Yeah.
Why? My question goes back to, I know that the brain is trying to survive. Why have we developed a habit that feels so bad for us? And why is it, again, it's so hard to defeat, even though it feels there's people that quit because of the chipping yips. They quit the game because of the chipping yips, right? This is the part that's still so foggy for me. Why does the brain allow us to develop such a bad habit that is so, so bad for us, but yet it feels so bad and we understand how bad it is. I get you trying to convince me that I need to quit drinking a Coke, but why do you also need to convince me when I know that yips are so bad?
Well, your brain doesn't think the yips are bad. Your old brain. Your old brain thinks it's helping you survive. And remember, it does not know the difference between a difficult chip and being chased by a saber-toothed tiger, right? So the yips is intensely reinforced. Right. If every time I come to a putt that is anxiety provoking for me and I jerk yip it through there, my brain is getting reinforced significantly for going, good job, you got through it, you're alive. Because again, remember, the yips starts with a perception of threat.
Yep. Yep. Okay.
I believe that this is a threatening enough event that I tell my brain, you better not let me screw up, yip again, embarrass myself, be judged, be the type of player that has the yips. Right. So essentially, the trigger is deeply threatening event, behavior, full-on panic mode, threat response, which is exactly what our brain is designed to produce. Okay. And every single time you yip, your brain is getting the exact reinforcer it thinks it's getting, which is, you're alive.
Yep.
Check.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
So even though it feels awful internally, your brain is not paying attention to that. It's paying attention to the fact that I got you through it alive. We have to really consciously pay attention to the fact that it feels so crappy in a non-judgmental way Otherwise, and we also have to show it, you are not saving me from the things that you think you're saving me from. So again, okay, that's what it feels like. And what are the actual consequences here?
In relation to
what you want. Yeah, go ahead.
And going back, because this was kind of my question about the club versus the saber-tooth tiger, right? Because the reactions are the same. The brain's not always great at basically judging the threat level of a really tough chip or a saber-tooth tiger. But you mentioned that the saber-tooth tiger is the trigger and the club's the trigger. It can differentiate between those two. So how do we keep the saber-tooth tiger threat response, which is a good one, and eliminate the wedge threat response, which is the yip, which is the bad one?
We have to be really clear with our brain what the trigger is, that it's okay, not a saber-tooth tiger.
Okay.
Right? So we have to actually say that you are not saving me. Like if we're asking, what are you actually getting? You are not saving me from a threat.
Okay.
Right. So again, part of this is also as you're getting into, which would be a future episodes, Chase, which is a lot of our habits that we develop, the triggers that we deem to be worthy of behaviors like anxiety or panic or the yips are in part determined by our psychological framework and what we perceive to be threats and what we don't, or to what degree they are threatening. Right. So here we go again with our conversation from our last Q&A. If my identity is at stake when I'm going to compete, the trigger is going to be identity threat.
Yeah.
Right. And then the behaviors that are going to come in response to a threat are going to be the types of things that we're talking about here that can eventually lead to the yips. And again, the reward for that is I'm protecting your identity. The problem is that's not what it's actually doing. And it feels really awful doing that.
Yep.
Right. It's the same thing. So the more clear you are with your brain that this trigger is not a threat, even though it feels like it, this behavior is not helping you do what you think it does because it feels awful and it is not at all doing what you think you're doing. And we show it over and over again. And again, not conceptually going, well, I shouldn't yip. Like it's no big deal that people are watching. I don't even really care. No, you have to actually show it repeatedly with your direct experience. This is not what's happening to you. So again, very difficult for us to move off of behaviors, including psychological behaviors, by thinking our way through them. We have to tie in our direct experience. So our brain learns in two ways, conceptually, and it learns through our direct experience. And it learns much faster and more efficiently through direct experience. Conceptual understanding matters because it puts shape and context around that direct experience. But you can't just learn how to be good at something or change a behavior or do anything with conceptual understanding alone. We need to experience things directly. So if conceptually I understand yips is not helpful for me and I build a bunch of direct evidence to support that, my brain starts to become less enchanted with that idea.
No, it's really interesting. And it does make sense. I've always believed that the yips were your brain trying to protect you, but I never really thought about it. Like old brain is like, man, job well done. Like I just saved you and I did exactly what I'm supposed to do. Right. And you're like, you know, feel like you just got electrocuted.
Sure.
And it feels so bad.
It feels awful. So again, think about the yips. Like if you were going to put this in a different context, like survival mode, it would be you walking through the forest, knowing there are predators all around, but not knowing when they're going to pop out. Like that's what it feels like.
What it feels like. That's good.
Right. And then when you actually see one, that jump, that startle, that's a yip in terms of how our brain works. We call it the yips in golf, but that's just a startle response is essentially just
that's
a
yip, what it is. Right? That's what it feels
like. It is
like,
a full on threat response to something that you are either anticipating, but don't know when it's coming, which is why it can happen at the back of your backswing. Or it can happen over the ball. You can feel like you black out during it.
Yeah.
It's a very uncomfortable experience. And it's also part of the reason why, again, if you were in that actual life-threatening situation, that is the exact response you would want. Because it is super, that jerky motion is fast relative to how we can deliberately move, right? So again, it is a survival mechanism applied to a thriving setting that, again, is just intensely uncomfortable. It just destroys physical skills because your brain is not at all interested in executing well. It's trying to get you either not to do something or to do it as fast and get it done with and on to the next thing. And that's what reinforces it over and over again. So here we see like the more I resist the things I don't want when putting, chipping, whatever, the more it feeds that anxiety, the more the yip gets reinforced. And the more when I actually drop kick a putt by jerking it and my brain goes, you're alive, it gets even more ingrained because that is essentially a heavy dose of reinforcement for your brain because it feels like for it, I made you safe when you weren't, which again, if we go all the way back to our negatively reinforced habits, The reason that they get reinforced is because they make us feel like I'm safe, or I'm more comfortable, or I'm more certain. Even if they don't, because again, your brain doesn't know the difference. The deepest parts of your brain don't know the difference between perceived and real. And it is designed to default to let me save you in any type of situation where you've told me I need to be saved.
Man, it's really interesting. I keep thinking back to like our old brain at times with the chipping yips is like your dog that you've trained to go fetch a ball, and you throw the ball in the wrong spot and it jumps through the coffee table, or it does what the dog thinks it's supposed to do. And then it looks back at you and you're like, you stupid dog, you didn't help me. You know, you completely ruined the whole living room. And he's just wagging his tail. And I just kind of pops. Yeah.
Here's a good example of yips, how they play out too. Imagine you have a dog that, like you have actually physically abused it. And then you just raise your hand to it, like it's going to flinch and it's going to duck.
For sure. Right?
So again, you're raising your hand is not a threat. Striking it actually is. Yep. Your brain, in terms of like when we're at the yips, it doesn't know the difference between missing a putt or making a putt or whatever. It's a, oh, this has been so bad for me before. You've told me at all costs, do not get hit. So it's going to flinch. Yep. And it's a learned response based on when I was in a similar situation before, trigger, slippery putt where people might judge me. Behavior. Oh man, I met this with anxiety and I drop kicked it. The reward for your brain was, oh man, good thing I gave you that anxiety to help you get through that. And if you do that repeatedly, it's caught.
Okay, so let's map. So we mapped it. Now, what does it feel like when you're engaged with this behavior? It feels horrible. I feel stuck at impact. I feel like I've gotten electrocuted. Like obviously there's a lot of bad feelings.
There's a ton. Yeah.
And then what do I actually get from this? I mean, I always joke and say absolutely nothing. I got nothing from this.
You might fill that in with nothing productive.
Yeah.
Because what you are getting is something, which is a safety first response. But what you might put in that is it makes putting unenjoyable, particularly certain types of putts. It makes short game unenjoyable. It makes golf unenjoyable. It destabilizes my confidence. You might go, it actually makes my muscles spasm to try to do something. Yep. It makes me want to just get through my round as fast as possible and then get to the nitty gritty. What's important to you? Yeah. It disrupts my skills. It makes me worry about performing in certain settings, et cetera. And by the way, also very difficult to make putts.
And so for 10 to 14 days, every time you go through this habit, you feel a trigger that induces a behavior that then go through the reward every time.
Yeah. Now, what you also might be noticing, Chase, is this is very different than a lot of surface level psychology that is telling you to just trust, just relax, just do whatever. Amen. And the reason, again, is it is almost impossible. Well, not almost impossible, but the circumstances have to be very, very specific for us to move from one deeply reinforced habit to another set of behaviors if you do not decrease the reward value for the current behavior. Essentially, you will not move off of a crappy golf ball to a better golf ball until I show you how crappy the first golf ball is with real direct evidence, not just conceptually, right?
Okay.
No different than why people get very defensive about stuff like they're very brand loyal or whatever. Like I would have to show you how bad something is performing before you would be open to something that is higher performing, unless your current habit is to be open to things that are higher performing, right? So again, the kind of a general example, but just trying to exemplify, we don't move from one option to another just willy-nilly very often. Our brain is designed to preserve the behaviors it has. Yep. To get off of them, I have to be consciously aware of them. That's stage one. And two, I have to lower the reward value, meaning I have to show my brain this is not nearly reinforcing what you think you're actually getting, and I don't like it.
Going back to pulling out a wedge versus a saber-tooth tiger, you are not protecting me. This wedge is not going to kill me. Like I'm going to be just fine.
Yeah. And again, we know that conceptually, but until you show your brain over and over again with real direct evidence that every time you do this, I drop kick a putt or I duff a putt or I do whatever, that it's not helpful and it feels awful, you're not going to think your way out of that behavior, because the part of your brain that consciously thinks and conceptually understands this isn't helpful is not the part of your brain running that habit, right? So you're asking the weakest and youngest and slowest parts of your brain to overpower the fastest and the strongest and the most powerful parts of your brain in a language that it doesn't speak.
So this is so interesting. It's like a demon. It's like the angel and the devil on your shoulder. And right now the devil in this case is old brain, and it's just doing its thing no matter the situation.
Yeah, but I might say that old brain is also the angel. Like, we have a lot of habits that are super productive for us that we don't have to think through. And our old brain is open to what we might call angelic behaviors, but we've got to show it that the devilish type ones are not working for it.
And I guess I keep cherry picking the bad ones in relationship to golf that are so hard to change and to fix. Right.
Right. And we might also say that most of the people listening to this podcast are interested in playing better golf, scoring better, getting better, having a better experience. And very likely, like every human being on the planet, you have a mixture of habits, some that are really helpful, some that are not. And in certain situations, those start to come to fruition. And ultimately, if we can help people get past those a little bit by understanding them better, 100%. Then we can get into it.
Yeah. Okay. So the trigger is a short-sided pitch over a bunker. The behavior is sweaty palms, nervousness, feeling anxious, feeling whatever. The reward is trying to get it done as quickly as possible, or trying to, like I always joke, trying to hit before my playing partners get up there so they don't.
Which is just another way of saying avoid judgment.
Avoid judgment. That's right. So I document, I write the three steps down for a week to 2 weeks. And then I've got to try to lower the reward value for this in order to change the habit, in order to basically tell my brain that I don't need to react to this particular trigger this way anymore.
Yeah. You can think of lowering reward value as just another way of saying showing your brain, your old brain, in the language that it speaks, how crappy and unproductive this behavior is or this habit is.
So be very specific in how do we feel when we're engaged in this behavior, and then what are we actually getting from this? So is there anything like, and that's basically, if the more I tell my brain how bad all this is, the more they're going to soften the reward value, basically. They're going to
lower it starts. Yeah, this is our process of disenchantment, meaning I got to show my brain in the language, and by the way, to myself and my conscious awareness too, this obviously does not work in relation to what it is that I want to experience, how I want to perform, you know, what I want this experience and my ability to be like in these types of situations.
Okay. Right?
And we do this, by the way, just organically, quite frequently in our lives. The challenge with it is if we're trying to thrive in settings, we want to try to accelerate that process, which is, you know, if you did something over and over and over again, getting the same, this is not working, eventually you might get fed up with it and change your behavior, which would be like an organic means of disenchantment. The problem is for most people in the world, like, we don't need to wait that long. If we know how to do it, we don't have to wait that long. And for some of the people that you and I work with, quite frankly, there are time constraints on their performance where you can't wait that long if you're going to get through the next level.
So is it once we've met, I mean, is it an automatic thing? Like, we do this for 2 weeks kind of religiously and it slowly goes away. Is there more stuff we've got to be aware of? Like, what are the next steps?
The next step, if we're going to do it in this episode, is stage three, which is you have to present your brain a better option.
Okay.
And that better option is there are some clear parameters to it that make it a better option, not just performance wise, but in the way that our brain actually encodes, this is better for us.
Okay. So we're at the hour mark. You know more about stage three than good Lord than I do. So if we want to wait and make this the next episode.
Let's do that.
Okay. So let's go kind of full on recap real quick. So in stage one mapping, we talked about writing down trigger, behavior, reward. Trigger is an event, behavior is the response to the event, the reward is the reason for the response, the feeling of or trying harder, what we're doing in response to the behavior, which is in response to the event. And then in stage two, we're basically trying to lower the reward value of a habit we're trying to change. We're really trying to eliminate, kind of, right? And so, behavior with a higher reward value means it's at the top of the list. It either makes me feel really good, it works really well, or it alleviates the most discomfort, the most uncertainty. It becomes more of a survival.
It feels like it does.
Feels like it does. Yeah. Quote unquote, air quotes. Right. And then I wrote down, we have to show the brain how unrewarding the behavior really is. And then it's through direct experience, asking ourselves two questions after the behavior. What does it feel like when we are engaged with this behavior, and be specific? And then what are we actually getting from this?
Actually getting. So you're essentially asking through conscious awareness, what is my sensory experience like in this? Feels like in physical sensations, emotional sensations, cognitive. What do I feel like when I'm engaged with this behavior? And then again, what is the actual cause and effect? that I get from this. So it's really asking, what do I actually get from this? Even though my brain thinks it's getting and feels like it's getting that, what am I actually getting? And it's that compare and contrast over time and over repetition that starts to lower that reward value and make that behavior less appealing to the part of your brain that is always looking for the most appealing option.
Fascinating. Hey, I think I survived stage two a little bit better than I survived stage one. I'm proud of myself. I kept up a little bit on this one.
You're doing awesome.
I read the chapter three times now, and I'm still like, okay, is that a behavior or is that a reward? And it's
probably not that important that you have to fine tooth comb them out.
Yep.
You just need to know that when our brain is designed to learn by that, when something happens, internal or external event, yep, we are going to respond with some level of either internal or external behavior or both.
Yep.
And there's a reason that we would do that. That's our reward. And that reason is either feels good and works, or it saves me from feeling bad. And a behavior works with is it makes me feel like I'm safe, I'm certain, I'm comfortable.
And I'm leaving this episode thinking kind of what you talked about already is that like this whole thing of like, I'm just going to convince myself how good I am, or I'm going to have confidence all the time or self-belief all the time. Yeah. It just doesn't work. I mean, it can for bits and pieces of time, but it makes it really hard.
What you're doing there is you are trying to manipulate a trigger.
Yeah.
Right. And what you're doing is you're trying to just replace one thought pattern with another when your brain has already made one thought pattern a habit and is designed to run it on automatic and isn't open to a better option, really,
yep,
which is why that surface level psychology stuff doesn't work. It doesn't actually essentially, like, your brain already thinks the pre-existing thought patterns that it has habitually been running have the highest reward value, even though they might not. To your brain, it does. And so if I just try to replace it, this is why in the book, I also discuss how trying to willpower our way to different internal and external behaviors is a very low percentage strategy. And also how trying to distract ourselves doesn't work, again, because you're messing with the triggers. And the bottom line is, if you're in a thriving setting, the triggers are going to be there.
Yep.
And you can't go through life avoiding triggers, whether we're talking about it in a therapeutic sense, a thriving sense, a surviving sense. Like, the world is, our brain is designed to respond to triggers. And if you try to manipulate them in order to get rid of them, then the question becomes, well, what if you can't? And the bottom line is, if you're going to play golf, there are certain triggers you cannot avoid. And so if I can't avoid them, that means I have to change the behavior. But my brain changes behaviors based on how reinforcing it is, not based on, oh, I don't like this anymore.
Man, this stuff's fascinating. Well, and again, like we say, the better you get, the more difficult it's going to get. Like, it doesn't get easier. None of this stuff gets easier.
Sure. So even let's just use one as an example as we're on our way out. If the trigger is failure, and my behaviors are a bunch of means to try to avoid failure at all costs.
Yep.
The reward for that is I feel like I'm doing something to avoid failure and move towards success. Well, what does it actually feel like? It does not feel very good. No. Like, it makes you more anxious. It makes you more frustrated. It makes you more panicky. You feel like you're walking on eggshells and you're doing a thing trying to not screw up. So you're in survival mode during a thriving setting. That does not feel good because, again, your brain is designed that when we tell it, you need to survive this, not thrive through this, that's all adrenaline, not dopamine. And so it's going to feel pretty crappy.
Yep.
Then you ask yourself, well, what am I actually getting from this? It's, I play poorly. I don't like the experience. My skills get disrupted. I jump from swing to swing. I'm sifting through swing thoughts constantly. I'm trying to avoid people that I don't want. I'm trying to avoid certain triggers, all these things. And you only have to show yourself that so many times before you start to go, man, I really like something better, which is exactly what stage three is about.
Oof, man, good stuff. For those of you that haven't bought the book or haven't read the book, Golf Beneath the Surface, on all major, I'm going to say platforms, but where all major books are sold, Amazon, wherever. If you guys have any questions so far about stage one mapping of habits, stage two mapping of habits, at GBTS podcast on Instagram, at BTS_mindset on Twitter, at Chase Cooper Golf on Instagram, fire the messages over. We'll do one more next week. Will be another one on habits, and then we'll follow that up, I'm sure, with a Q&A that is directly related to habits. And as we end, I think back to how I completely butchered our at GBTS podcast handle 2 weeks ago. It still makes me crack up. Hey Doc, I'm blaming that on you. It'd been too long since we had done it. I completely forgot. I was
I was
100% through like 16 or 17 episodes, and then we had a 2 month hiatus, and I completely forgot, lost all sense. So,
trigger, Chase screws up, behavior, blame Raymond, reward, avoid blame,
avoidance at all costs. Your fault. So, all right, Doc, take us home.
Well, that's it. It's a complicated subject at times, but hopefully we're simplifying it for people. Please, again, as Chase said, let us know what questions you have, and we will see you next time when we talk episode 3 of Habits.